This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our speaker this morning was Wick Moorman, the president and CEO of Amtrak. He was introduced by Mayor Rahm Emanuel, and the mayor said this is the first time he had ever introduced a non-commissioner or member of his cabinet. Wick is here today because there will be some important announcements regarding the future of the Union Station and Union Station area. He talked about Amtrak, which was founded in 1971, as a private corporation. It is not a government agency. And Amtrak operates over 500 train stations in the United States. They're intended to, they were created as a for-profit corporation, but they will never make a profit, he said. Last year, they managed to convey 94% of their operating costs that were met. There's a tremendous amount of reorganization going on in Amtrak today, an emphasis on equipment that must be updated, obtaining and keeping government funding so they can grow and develop. Their long-distance train business is only 15% of their ridership, but it produces about 25% of their revenue. 50% of their ridership is within states or between neighboring states, and the state pays to make up for any operating losses. Their great growth area is in short-distance railroad rides. People like to avoid driving. He talked about the Northeast Corner, that busy corridor where Amtrak owns all but 50 miles of track between Boston and Washington, D.C. In that area, 2,200 trains a day operate, and at Penn Station, 650,000 people go through that station every single day. The question was asked, will Amtrak ever be privatized? He said that was the reason why Amtrak was established several decades ago, that the private railroad companies could not make it work. He said we have to think of Amtrak as a hybrid, an important company and contributor to our way of life, and we must provide better experiences for those who choose to ride Amtrak.
Good morning to everybody. Thank you. I do want to, Wick, I want you to know, I usually come here, Rebecca will tell you, and introduce all my commissioners so they can give an accounting to the public of what's going on in the department, what are both the past, but also more importantly, the future and the investments we're making. I have never introduced a non-commissioner of my cabinet, but I know you feel over the last 3 years as if you were a commissioner. Am I? This is only a formality then. So Wick is now, after today, off my speed dial. And I think he's really appreciated. One way or another, this was going to get done. That's a bit of, we were just together a month and a half ago. I will say this. I've known Wick for a while, back to my congressional and White House days, when he was CEO of a major rail company. And very not frequently do you get somebody from the private sector who's willing to do be selfless and go back into doing public service and in taking a hard job like he has taken from Amtrak. And on behalf of everybody, not just the residents of the city of Chicago, but I want to thank you for your commitment to public service even after your time in the private sector. Please give him. And it's just a matter of fact, today is a, for the city of Chicago, a milestone of a day. And I want to try to put this in a context of what obviously Wick's going to talk about, Union Station, Amtrak. We have a big announcement today as a city and Amtrak together about something that is a significant transportation, I hate using this word, but asset for the city of Chicago. But put it in a larger context because I think you should draw a contrast between Chicago and New York as a whole on every effort. Just this week, the city of Chicago moved forward on our plans to modernize Midway Airport, not just in the retail space, but the security space, the transportation space, and allow the city of Chicago, from an aviation standpoint at Midway, it's about been about 15 years, to make a major investment that will take Midway Airport into the next level for the city of Chicago. About a year ago, we secured the funds to finish the modernization of the runways at O'Hare. And I need you to think about it this way. It's not just the modernization of the runways. When we are done with that project, we'll have literally lifted the capacity of Midway and moved it to O'Hare. So the city of Chicago is the only city that basically added a third airport in the last decade. and that is how to actually see that modernization. And we're, as you know, in the midst of a negotiation with the two major carriers at O'Hare about modernizing that effort. We also then have embarked on a major modernization of our public transportation system, completing the Red Line modernization, the new Blue modernization, the track throughout the city of Chicago. Almost half the track will be new, and we have also either refurbished or totally rebuilt about 45 L stations in the city of Chicago, from 95th all the way up north to everything in between, so making sure that people can get to work conveniently, efficiently, as somebody who uses CTA. Now, Union Station, if it was an airport, would be the 12th busiest airport in the United States of America. So it's not, yes, it's tremendous, not only foot traffic, but it is when you think about it. So the city of Chicago is the only city in the United States of America, Canada, and Mexico, that American, United, and Southwest have their major operations. Only city, which allows it to, which is why the city of Chicago is the number one city in the United States for corporate relocation every year for the last 5 years. Number one city every year for the last 5 years in direct foreign investment. Only city in the United States last year on the top 20 worldwide. Every year for the last 5 years, Chicago's economy has grown faster than the United States and faster than New York and D.C. because we're willing to do the tough things that are necessary to invest in our future. And one of the key pieces, while education is the most important, is our transportation. That defined our past, and it's defining our future. And today's announcement, which I'll leave and I know we're going to be doing later on at an official press conference at Union Station, is about investing in one of the most important transportation hubs in the United States of America, and that's key to Chicago's economic future. When you bring together Amtrak, Metra, the Blue Line, and our rapid bus services, also all there, it is a tremendous hub of transportation assets that allow the city of Chicago and the Metro Chicago economy to move at the pace that it needs to move. Today is a milestone that embarks on a new future. We all know the past of Union Station. It's rich. With today's announcement, we invest in a future that will be richer than the past, one that is not just nostalgic, but one that allows the Chicago economy to continue to grow, be vibrant, and continue to allow the city of Chicago to be a world-class economy. And if you look at everything we're doing from aviation to public transportation to then what we're doing here at Union Station, I am a middle child, you all know that, it stands in contrast to what's going on in another city in the Northeast that where has gone to total gridlock. And Chicago, by investing and doing the things that are necessary with somebody like Wick, who has been tremendous in leading and being very pragmatic, what does it take to grow? Today is a milestone, yes, for Amtrak. And I want to thank Wick for allowing the city of Chicago to be part of that milestone, not just for Amtrak, but because of Union Station's history in the city and what it will mean to the future, allowing us to share in embarking on a new future together that I think will make Chicago incredibly strong, incredibly vibrant, and continue to be a world-class economy that competes at a world-class level. With it, please give a warm welcome, a Chicago welcome, to Wick Moorman.
Thank you so much, Mayor Emanuel. It's great to be here. My thanks to the City Club for inviting me today. My thanks to all of you for coming, but my thanks in particular to the mayor, who, as he mentioned, I have met sporadically over the course of the last 10 years or so in my other career. I can tell you, as a member of the business community, that the mayor used the word pragmatism, and he was always known in the business community for his vision and his pragmatism. His willingness to support good ideas going forward for Chicago and the nation, and his willingness when a bad idea came along to politely but forcefully express that that wasn't the best idea that you might have had. both very valuable and much appreciated. So what I'd like to do this morning for just a few minutes is talk about Amtrak and give you kind of rather than tell you about all the great things that are going on at Amtrak and all the terrific people at Amtrak, there are a bunch of them sitting there, barred up here, and the credit for all of the great work that's gone on in Chicago certainly goes to them and not to me. But give you a perspective of the company. I can talk for hours about it and tell you many great things. But I thought I'd just kind of describe what it is and what I think it can be, and then take some time to answer your questions about what you think is important and what you'd like to hear. Before I get into Amtrak, let me talk about an even more interesting subject, myself. Just to give you a perspective and kind of a disclaimer on what the kind things the mayor said about me. The first thing you should know is that I was one of these crazy kids who loved trains. Like some people, just never seemed to grow out of it. I was fortunate enough to get a job very early on in 1970. I went off to Georgia Tech and got an engineering co-op job with a company called the Southern Railway. For those of you who weren't around in 1970 and want to look it up, that was in the late Paleozoic era. So I went on then to have a truly wonderful career at Southern Railway and then its successor company, Norfolk Southern, and I ended up as CEO, which was just, you know, a dream came true, and served almost 10 years in that position. And then stepped down in mid-2015 as CEO to my wife's great delight. We moved to a wonderful town called Charlottesville, Virginia, where our grandchildren live 20 minutes away from us. We're on a small farm. Idyllic, I think is the word. And I've had an extraordinarily happy year of retirement. And then the chairman of Amtrak and a couple of board members, Jeff Moreland, whom some of you know from Chicago, approached me about this job. I did the right thing, and I said no. And then I said, but I'd be willing to help in some way if I could, because I think, one, this is an industry that I feel very, very strongly about, and I think Amtrak's very important. And that was a mistake to say I'd help, because after an unsuccessful search, the chairman, gentleman named Tony Kosha, came back and, to my wife's utter disgust, talked me into doing this. And I did it. I've tried to analyze the reasons that I've done it. And the first, I would say, is what I said. You know, I've blessed in every possible way. And I feel very strongly about the railroad industry, and this was the way to do something for the railroad industry. Even more importantly, I do view this as some form of public service in which I don't have to run for office or have extensive background checks or, you know, anything like that. Not that there's anything wrong with that. And the third, just to put a damper on it, was a pretty unhealthy dose of ego. It's one thing when everybody, because there were a lot of people saying this in the industry, oh, Wick would be perfect for Amtrak. That's fine. But when you start to believe it yourself, you're making a mistake. And I did. So I wasn't, I don't know that I'm perfect, but I came in last September. We've been doing good things since then, and today is obviously a great thing and a real testament to the people of Amtrak. And I'm always asked what surprised me when I got there, and I always say the most pleasant surprise by far was the caliber of the people. We have great people all across the company, people who understand what Amtrak is, understand what it should be and can be, and understand that we need to focus on the things that are important, focus on our partners like the city of Chicago, focus on our customers, and make sure that we pay attention to everything that we can to make sure that those relationships and that customer relationship in particular are as strong as they can be. So let me back up, and as I take my watch off to make sure I'm not going to ramble on too long, talk for a minute about Amtrak. And there's a saying that I have that I always want to use, talking about Amtrak, to talk about Amtrak, what it is and what it isn't. Because there are some number of misperceptions about it or myths about it that I think are important to discuss. And it starts all the way back in 1971 when Amtrak started operations. And you have to remember back then that the railroad industry itself was in disarray. This was shortly after the Penn Central bankruptcy, the largest bankruptcy in the history of the country at that time. The Northeast railroads were imploding. There was not the industry in the Midwest. A lot of you remember the Rock Island was imploding. There were a few strong companies. I was fortunate to work for one, Southern Railway. But the railroad's financial situation was just terrible. The infrastructure was bad. And the key question that was being asked at that time was, should the railroads be nationalized? And some portion of their financial distress was driven by the passenger trains. The railroads invested heavily in passenger business coming out of World War II and then saw that business decimated by the construction of the interstate highway system and the advent of commercial air travel. And traffic started to drop and money started to flow out. And the railroads started as fast as they could to start to get rid of passenger trains. But there was a lot of pushback by public utility commissions in the states and other forces that wanted to keep some amount of passenger trains going for reasons that I'll talk about in a minute. And very valid reasons. So Amtrak was conceived as this kind of grand bargain by the people in a government agency to preserve a national rail network and get the load off of the freight railroads. And the freight railroads' deal was they contributed the equipment, essentially, and they allowed the passenger trains to run on their networks at marginal costs. So that was the deal that was made, and it was it was a rational and a good deal at the time for everyone, although there are people that forget that that deal was made a long time ago. So let me talk about a couple of key concepts that are important today coming out of that. The first is that Amtrak was created as a corporation. In fact, it was created as a for-profit corporation. Now, the folks who created it never really thought it would make money. In fact, there is no big passenger rail network anywhere in the world that makes money, certainly on a GAAP basis, but very few even cover their operating costs. Amtrak, by the way, last year covered 94% of its operating costs, which is an extraordinary number when you go around the world and see what other financial situations look like. But they convinced the world that this might make a profit, and that has lived with us ever since. And that is just something that we need to work through. We need to keep pushing, and I think someday maybe we can get close to break even, and that would be wonderful. That would be extraordinary. But it's a corporation. That's the key thing. It's not an agency. And I correct people all the time when they call us an agency. We have a board, albeit presidentially appointed, but we have a board, we have a CEO, we run like a company. And that is the message that I have been preaching to everyone at Amtrak since I arrived. We have to compare ourselves to other good companies. And we have to make sure that we perform like other good companies. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means four things, and these are the four things that when I came in were what I called my tier one issues. The first was organize appropriately. Organize to address the business issues and make a success and then get the right people in the right places in the organization. And we, in fact, have done that. We have separated out a kind of a mixture of commercial and operating organization and had people now focusing on the commercial lines and our three businesses and people focused on operations. And I think that's a much better way to do business. The second, and this is just something that I think in particular is important, is focus on creating a great safety culture. You know, the Class I railroads have done that. And I have been fortunate enough to be exposed to a couple of other great companies of which I'm on the board. And they have great safety cultures, and Norfolk Southern had a great safety culture. And I firmly believe that until you have the discipline and the culture in place to be great at safety, you can't have a great company, right? You can't be a strong company operationally if you don't have good safety. You can't have great customer service unless you have safety. So we are extraordinarily focused and will remain focused on that as a building block to item number three, which is operational excellence, right? We have a mandate to do certain things, and from the government. Our job is to do that as efficiently and effectively as we possibly can, and we need to be better at that, and we can be better at that. And then fourth, we need to do something that I think Amtrak had lost sight of a little bit, and in some ways justifiably so, because of these enormous pressures that come from at least certain members of Congress all the time, you know, and initiatives that were taken on 10 and 20 years ago to kill the company. We need to focus on the customer. We need to make sure that we run well, we save money everywhere we can, but we don't go out and just try and penny pinch and save money at the expense of the customer experience. And that's something I think that we probably done in Amtrak before. We're not going to do that today. So, and when I say customer experience, that's all the way from ticketing and, you know, e-ticketing and some things we do very well to stations and the station experience. And you have this magnificent station here, just a wonderful, wonderful station, a treasure, I think, for the city. It goes to customer interactions with all of our train crews, our onboard service professionals, right? That we have the right training and the right attitude, and we have customers-focused people on those trains trying to help people try to solve their problems and doing it in the right way consistently and diligently. We have enormous numbers of people who want to do that, but we can train better and make sure that it's a more common experience across our ridership. And finally, our equipment. We got some shabby stuff out there. We have a lot of old equipment. But that doesn't mean we can't take care of it and refurbish the interiors and do things that at least provide a good experience so that when you walk on an Amtrak train, you say, oh, this is nice. You know, the airlines do it with 40 and 50-year-old airplanes. You know, you don't want to know how old some of the airplanes you fly on are, right? Look for the little plaque on old Boeing airplanes. It's right there at the door. It says when it was built. Or maybe don't want to look. But you walk on it, you can have a great experience. And we, in fact, are starting down that path of refurbishing some of our oldest equipment, and I hope we'll continue to do it. So those are the four things, and I think we can do that. I think there are a lot of great things, and I could tell you all about them that are going on today, and I have a long list which people gave me. But let me shift gears a little bit and talk about Amtrak in another sense. Not only are we a corporation, in my opinion, we're a government contractor, right? We're, in some sense, without offending those of you in the defense industry, we're not that much different than a company in the defense industry or a highway contractor or whomever else it is that's really dependent on funding from the government. The key difference is the business model, right? Lockheed Martin or Northrop Grumman or whoever's highway construction company have a business model where they charge the government directly for their services. And by doing so, they're able to charge an amount that has a margin that can provide for future investment, pay shareholder returns. And that's a good business model. I came out of that world, and that's a world that's made our country what it is to a large extent. Amtrak just has a business model. We rely on user fees. User fees in the form of both ticket revenue and state support and commuter agency support for using our assets. And then we go to the government directly for the rest of the money. We go to the government directly for subsidizing our operating loss. Our operating loss last year was about $230 million. As I say, we covered 94% of our operating costs internally. And we go to the government for capital. And that's kind of the more important piece, because one thing that is true about Amtrak is after 45, 46 years of existence, there have been some very lean times in terms of capital investment. And we see that in particular with our equipment, and even more so with the Northeast Corridor, where we are running a lot of trains on some very old assets. But as I say, we're a government contractor, we have a business model, and even though the business model might be problematic, that's no excuse not to run a great company and not to be focused in everything we do on running that great company. Let me wind up by talking a little bit about Amtrak today and what it is and where I think we're going. We have three businesses today. We have, first and foremost, in some sense, the long-distance business. That's why we were created, right, all those years ago, to preserve that network. That network has shrunk a little, but by and large, it's in place. It's only about 15% of our ridership. It's a little more than that, than our revenue, because we run trains a long way. And interestingly enough, even though we run trains from Chicago, as you know, to Seattle, to Oakland, to L.A., most people don't ride from Chicago to L.A. Most people, only about 10% of our ridership on any train does that. Most of them use it for intermediate ridership, for connecting city pairs. And from the standpoint of the importance of the long-distance network, something like 56% of the rural population of this country is within 50 miles of an Amtrak station. And we go through a lot of places where Amtrak is really it in terms of public transportation. And I think that's an important service. And our the government, with whom we contract to provide services, has always felt that's important as well. The issue with the long-distance service, of course, is that if you look at it from a financial standpoint, that's where a lot of the losses are. If you Amtrak, like a lot of network businesses, has a lot of allocated costs, right? You allocate the cost of the reservation system, right? You allocate the cost of the law department. You allocate the CEO's salary. So that 8 1/3 cents a month I was making, you know, is spread out according to certain formulas. That was before, for reasons that had to do with my other pension income. My salary went to zero, but that's okay. But if you look at the long distance, if you look at all of our businesses, we try very hard to allocate based on rational kinds of things, you know, passenger miles or train starts. You know, it's a formula that was actually developed by the Volpe Institute under the FRA, or the direction of the FRA. If you look at the money for the long-distance service, and this is obviously a long-distance service hub for us, we kind of break even if you just take pure, like, how much did the fuel and the crews cost? The basic run that train today cost, we're pretty close to break even. Once you start allocating, it ends up that it loses, and I think this is a rational number, it ends up losing about $500 million a year. So the bulk of our loss and then some. The next business we have is the state-supported business, and this is a hub for a lot of our state-supported businesses, right? The Michigan service, you know, the St. Louis service, the service up to Minneapolis. And the deal there, that's 50% of our ridership, by the way. The deal there, and this was formalized in the PREA Act in 2009, is essentially that if the state wants the service, there was a lot of state service that was out there before, and some got it for free almost, and some paid, depending on when it started, is that the state makes up the operating cost loss and pays us some amount of capital. And we're far enough along in our agreements to where that business is closer to break even for us. In a fully allocated basis, it still loses, I guess, $80 or $90 million a year, but that can be straightened out. It's the growing business. It's the business that I think Amtrak and rail passenger travel are going towards in this country, right? It's this shorter distance, and particularly shorter distance rail travel into places where you say to yourself, do I really want to drive to downtown Chicago today? Right? So, and a great example, I live in Charlottesville, as I mentioned. My office is in Washington. There's a train from Charlottesville to Washington. It's 120 miles, plus or minus. It's not a quick trip. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes. We make a number of stops, and it's still faster than if I ever tried to drive to Union Station in the morning. You know, the last thing in the world, if you go east, and some of you do, don't ever get on Interstate 95 if you can help it. I guess the same's true for the Dan Ryan or one of them? Yeah. That's the growth opportunity for Amtrak, right? Is those corridors, those rail corridors. And we can a lot of times use the long distance network to help set the stage for that. Then the last thing is the corridor, the Northeast Corridor. We own all but 50 miles between Washington and Boston. We operate over the whole thing. It's like no other railroad in the country and very few in the world. There are 2,200 trains a day on the corridor. Amtrak operates 150 of them. 7 commuter agencies use some part of it. Penn Station, where I've been spending far more time than I would like to for the past 6 weeks, is the biggest single transportation hub in the country. 650,000 people a day between the Long Island Railroad, New Jersey Transit, Amtrak, and the subways go through Penn Station every day. And while you have a magnificent and wonderful station, how many of you have been through New York Penn? Of course, right? They tore down the magnificent station in the 60s when the railroad business was perceived to be dying. And there's a quote from some famous architect to the extent that we used to arrive in New York like gods, and now we scuttle in like rats. it's a tough place. But the corridor... Right? Because the business model works, because it looks more like an airline. We shuttle assets quickly. We put a lot of people on those assets, high density, all of those things. The corridor generates cash. Even after allocated costs, it generates cash. Its problem is that if you look at it in a rational basis and look at all the 100-year-old plus assets we have up there, the best estimate is make up a number, but it's like $30 to $35 billion worth of capital required over the next 20 years, including, as many of you know, 2 new tunnels under the Hudson River, because these two have been flooded and by Sandy, and we don't think they're going to last forever, and on and on and on. So it's an interesting set of businesses. They fit together as a whole. And that's an important point, because one of the things, other myths is, why don't we privatize Amtrak, right? All of you read that. All of you, it would be so much better because Amtrak is lame and these private companies will get in and fix it. Of course, what they forget is the reason Amtrak was created is private companies couldn't make it work, right? It's essentially not a good business model. And then they say, well, privatize the corridor because it generates cash. On a GAAP basis, it loses money. It doesn't generate the money that's needed for reinvestment. So it's a peculiar company. It's a little bit of a hybrid, but it's an important company. And it's a company that can do great things. And we are doing good things everywhere. We are making our customers' experiences better. We set a ridership revenue. And I think we are on the cusp of becoming a truly great company and expanding rail passenger travel all across the country, because all of a sudden, for all those true believers in 1971 who said, this is important, this needs to be preserved, the world has come to a place where people are looking around and saying, why don't we go by train? What a great idea. And I think that Amtrak is poised to fulfill that mission, and I think that we will do it very well. So thanks, and I will be happy to take questions about whatever you would like to talk about. All right. Do we have time for questions?
Absolutely. We certainly do. Thank you. Thank you, Wick. Thank you very much. Okay, we have time for questions, ladies and gentlemen. So if anyone has any question, if you filled out a question on those blue cards, just hold your hand up in the air, and our staff, there's one way back there, Mr. Clark. Oops.
I'll tell you a quick story about filling out cards. The first town hall meeting I ever did, I was in information technology at NS, and I went to Roanoke where we had an office, and I was going to do a town hall and take questions, and they said, well, we'll put a box out in front for them. And I said, well, I'll just, people can raise their hands. They said, no, we'll put a box out. And so I picked the first one out, and I looked at it, and I promise you that it had the aura of, if this person had had time to cut words out of a newspaper and tape them, was typewritten anonymously. When are you going to shut down Roanoke? Okay, so anyway.
Okay, you can tell. He went to work for the green locomotives with the yellow design, the Southern Railway, right? Okay. First question from Nessa Sweet of the Braided River Group. Can you speak to the future of long-distance trains?
Yeah, that's a really good question and very timely because, as you know, and actually the full budget's out now, in the so-called skinny budget that the administration released, they their proposal, and they now have in their budget the funding that would do that, said, let's stop supporting long distance and focus on states and the corridor and cut the money accordingly. Well, there are two or three things I would say. The first is I think that there is a very rational argument to run that the government should run the long-distance passenger service for the public good, and the government supports a lot of things, as you know, for the public good. Furthermore, our relationship at Amtrak, this is another little-known fact, with the Hill now in Congress, on both sides of the aisle, is probably as good as it's ever been, you know. When I have a Republican senator from the West tell me how important rail passenger transportation is to his state, that's a change, right? So I don't think we have to see where it all goes. I don't think there's any appetite in Congress to do anything about the proposal. And, in fact, if you looked at the budget compromise that they just reached to get us to September, we got more money rather than less. And the third thing, which the point we make, and I'll go back, and the reason I mentioned the allocated cost is if we were to say, if somebody said, look, you're losing $500 million on long-distance network, cut them out. Well, the problem is all the $500 million in revenue would go away. We have a significant amount of labor protection for the next 4 or 5 years, so most of the labor costs would not go away. All of the allocated costs would get dumped over on the other businesses, and the net result is we'd stop investing in the Northeast Corridor. So I'm optimistic.
Okay, thank you, Wick. This is from Ryan Griffin Stenke. Sorry if I butchered your last name. The negative image of passenger rail as a business that requires subsidies conveniently ignores how heavily we subsidize highways and airlines. How do we go about leveling the playing field?
Great question.
We only have great questions at Citi.
I knew that. Education. Right? Education. Get out and tell our story. I think that's one of the reasons we have better relationships on the Hill. Amtrak in the past few years has done a very good job of getting out and telling that story. And as more and more people and more are exposed to passenger rail in other parts of the world and come to understand that economics there, then there's just more of an acceptance of, okay, you know, this is important. This is what we need to do. And it will take a long time for that to change completely, but I do believe the tide has turned.
Okay, thank you. This is from Ken Thompson, DePaul University. Do you see any chance of improving service and equipment outside the Northeast Corridor under this administration?
I don't think, I look puzzled. I know, but this is a frequent phenomenon. I wouldn't talk about it in terms of this administration, right? Administrations all have philosophies, and then, you know, we see what Congress ultimately does. I think there's a great question there about improving equipment. If you look at our equipment, it's old. We have the Northeast Corridor. We have now a new electric locomotive fleet, which was overdue. We have, and this is a lot of credit to people at Amtrak, we have ordered the next generation of Acela, and it'll be coming online in 2021. And for those of you who have ever used the corridor and taken the Acela product, it's good. The next generation will be great. Absolutely great, comparable to anything in Europe. And, in fact, these are the same supplier and same trains that TGV is looking at for their next generation. So what do we do about the equipment? Because we have old diesel locomotives, and that's the long-distance network, and a lot of old cars. Well, I mentioned we're starting a refurbishment program on the oldest set of coaches, and that's the corridor coaches because they're oldest, and it's also a lot of state-supported trains. So I think that's the first step, and we can afford to do that, right? We have the money to kind of put a program in to start doing good business sense things, and my expectation is that that program will then roll into the next generation of cars and then to the superliners on the long-distance trains. I think Amtrak has within itself, at the funding levels that we see today are slightly higher, the ability to do that. We have the ability to go start working on that diesel locomotive fleet. But there's a mindset thing at Amtrak that's changing, and it has to change, and that is that because it's been under such financial pressure and because there's been this uncertainty about, well, how much money are we going to get this year, that there really hasn't been kind of the mindset of let's plan a five-year program, right? Let's commit to a five-year program to do equipment work or to do locomotive work or whatever it is, or to do track work. And the simple fact of the matter is, if you look at our funding levels for the past number of years, they've been reasonably stable. And businesses, all of you are in business, you know, you make five-year plans, right? You kind of go down the road. You don't commit all your money for next year, but you make a commitment. You're going to spend some amount of money next year, and you're going to plan for it and keep going ahead. And we need to get into that mindset of let's put those longer-term programs in place, because the odds are really good that we can afford them. And just like business, if something bad happens, you take action and you delay it a year or you do whatever you need to. So I'm optimistic we can keep working on this with any administration. If you'll allow me, I think the key issue for this administration, which all of you are so aware of, right, is what are they going to do about infrastructure? That's the big question, because there's leaving alone what's going on in Washington these days, there is clearly a bipartisan belief in a big infrastructure package. And I will tell you what all of you know is that the economic competitiveness of the United States in the next 20-plus years depends upon investment in infrastructure. It was the investment in infrastructure in the 60s and the 70s that gave us the decades of prosperity that we've had. And my hope is that they'll pass that. I think they will do some things for Amtrak if they do that are important. And we'll just keep our fingers crossed.
Okay. Thank you, Wick. This is from Fred Owens with HOH. Is Amtrak considering concrete-supported rail slab track for high-speed, high-use lines? Must be an HO man. I don't know, HOH.
HOH, I know. You know, There have been railroads around the world. I'm an old track guy, so I ought to know something about this. There have been railroads that have looked at that. I think that by and large, we are going to, you know, our plan is to stay, unless it's in kind of special situations, tunnels and things like that, with kind of the conventional track structure. The corridor right now, it's concrete ties with welded rail. Part of that driven by the fact that in some sense, you know, slab track in theory is you don't need to maintain quite so well, or it lasts longer, but we have the equipment, we have the know-how to maintain the current system. And there are pieces of the railroad, there are a substantial number of pieces of the corridor where we run freight trains, which is almost unheard of anywhere else in the world. Norfolk Southern runs, you know, coal trains and other things up and down the corridor, and that tends to degrade the infrastructure, degrade the surface of the track, and so I think we need to probably stay with where we are. Although, if you want to come up and persuade me that I'm wrong, I'm certainly willing to listen.
Very good. Thank you. This is from Kevin Brubaker, who's with the Environmental Law and Policy Center. What is the solution to the problem of freight railroads not allowing Amtrak to achieve on-time performance? You can tell him the solution, then he can come up with all the dough.
Well, it's that's the question we always get. And as the CEO of her 10 years of a freight railroad, I guess I have a balanced perspective. It's hard to run a railroad, just so you'll know. That's a tough environment out there. And railroads are businesses. You know, freight railroads are businesses with shareholders to satisfy, customers to satisfy. By and large, the freights try to help us. Now, try is a word with some degree of variability, and some are better than others. But even the ones who try have a tough time getting us to like 80% on time, if for no other reason that there's always something, you know, when you run a train from here to Oakland, California, there's a lot that can go wrong on the railroad in between here and there. You know, the Amtrak train or the train ahead or three trains ahead can have an incident at a railroad crossing. They can lose their brakes. There are all kinds of things that can happen. And we're never going to – we can't fix that. There's just so far we can go. We can try very hard with the railroads who are not giving us the ride we think we should have, that are clearly parking us for freight trains occasionally, to work with them. But we don't, in all seriousness, we just don't have that much leverage. And I spoke, and one of the reasons I mentioned this grand bargain in 1971, you know, the folks who struck that bargain are long gone. And the people who run the freight railroads today look out there and they say, let's see, you want me to give this train the very highest priority and you're not paying me anything to run it. That's the way they look at it. And so it makes it tough. And the really tough part in terms of money is there's nothing – I mean, you know, we do give some incentives for on-time performance, but if you give – Norfolk Southern or BNSF or whomever, $5 million for running your train better, you know, in a company with a $22 billion or $30 billion, whatever it is, market cap, it's not material. It doesn't move the needle. Because if they say, I'm making trade-offs and you want me to hold this important customer's train for your train, if I lose that customer – and there's a lot of competition out there, and they go somewhere else, that swings the needle far more than Amtrak can. It's hard. I know all the freight railroad CEOs, obviously. I talk to them. And they understand Amtrak. It's not that they're trying to deliberately do things to us. But, you know, they got a railroad to run, and we're not the top priority for them. It's just that simple.
Thank you. We have time for a few more questions, if that's okay with you.
Yes, sir.
Great. This is from Mike Lieber with the Lieber Law Group. What are the chances that the line from Chicago to Milwaukee is upgraded to high-ish speed rail, 110 miles an hour, or truly high-speed rail?
You know, I'm not going to answer that question because I'm going to be very honest with you. I don't know the answer. I just don't know the state of play with that. Obviously, you know, I'll go back to it. That's a host railroad, right? So you have to work with the host railroad to do anything like that and see what they think it costs and see what the ongoing maintenance costs are and things like that. But let me answer something I think most of you probably know, a tangential question about truly high-speed rail. Why don't we run like, you know, the TGV or someone like that, or the Japanese or someone like that? Well, about 50 years ago, the Japanese with the Shinkansen trains figured something out, and that was that the state of the technology even then had reached a point where if you put overhead catenary in and put electrification in, you could pump enough horsepower into a train that hills didn't matter so much, right? You could run fast up a hill that in the past would have been constraining in terms of speed. But what you can't do is go around curves fast. And it's all about alignment. So when somebody says, well, why don't you run 160 or 200 straight out from New York to Washington, the answer is that when that railroad was built and then realigned 80, 90 years ago or whatever it was, like 80 to 100 was the aspirational speed. And so they're just curves that keep you from doing that. So the Europeans and the Japanese and the Chinese and all the other folks made a very different public transportation decision than the United States has, because their distances are shorter and all those kinds of things. They went out and built new alignments. The other thing you can't do in truly high speed is you can't mix anything else with the truly high speed. You can't run freight trains on it. You can't run stopping commuter trains on it. You can't do any of those things. So you hear these ideas, which just drive me up the wall sometimes. You know, there's a group kind of wandering around Washington and talking on TV about maglev, right? Maglev between New York and Washington. And maglev, for all kinds of reasons, is just, I don't think it's the thing. I'll just say it like that. But it would require completely new alignment. It requires that $100 billion straight alignment because maglev doesn't like railroad like that either, right? The problem is you go spend $100 billion on it, you still got to spend 30 or 40 or 50 on the corridor because all the commuters are going to stay over there. All the stopping trains are going to stay over there. So truly high-speed rail, in my opinion, in this country will eventually come somewhere. The best possibility for it coming to fruition, although they're working in California, is maybe Texas, the group down there that's promoting Houston to Dallas, which is about the right distance, and they've got some private funding, and, you know, we'll see what happens. But truly high-speed rail across this country is a long way away.
Thank you. We have time for two more questions. This is from Bob Johnston with Trains Magazine. As of late May, there has still not been a grant and legislative request submitted to Congress for fiscal year 18. Any idea when you expect it to be released?
You always know that Bob is going to ask you some kind of question. And then probably Bob posted on the train's website, right?
By the time we leave here.
By the time we leave. No, that's a very good, reasonable question. Typically, the whole budget process is slow this year, been delayed. And typically the legislative and grant request goes in formally right around the time that the formal budget has been released. So that's been released. We should see the legend grant shortly. It's just about ready to go. So.
Okay, one last question. This is from Paul Markles with Richard Crane. Can you speak about Amtrak and its positive economic impact? A nice short question.
Well, I'll start with the negative impact. There's a study about the Northeast Corridor in particular that says every day it doesn't run, it would cost the country $100 million. So that's what it's worth today. And you're starting to see more and more positive impact studies all around, particularly the state trains and the regional trains, in terms of, you know, this idea they're going to take some people off the highways, and that lessens the pressure there. And, you know, you all read and you all live through, like I do, right, the productivity lost in commuting. So things that ease urban transportation, facilitate urban transportation, facilitate business being done, because if you're a business person, you're riding, like I do, into Washington on the train, I do things while I'm on the train. And by the way, Amtrak is very focused on enhancing the Wi-Fi on all of our trains. This is something that's just being talked about more and more. Another kind of to end up since this last question, another huge thing that people all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, have been talking about and talk more about with regard to both transit and Amtrak is the economic development around a transportation center, right? When you have a vibrant transportation hub, there's all of a sudden buildings start to go up, right? People start to move close. And I think that's something that we're now much more focused on at Amtrak. We serve 500 plus stations. We don't own, interestingly enough, most of them. Most of them are owned by communities or agencies of some kind or another. But even there, we're trying to work with folks to make sure that we can help bring that positive economic impact, not only because people are riding the trains, but around the stations that they use. That it?
That's it. Let's give Wick a big hand.